This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The arrest today of Huda Salih Mahdi Amash, the only woman in the deck of Iraq's 55 most wanted, brings the total in U.S. custody to 19. Saddam Hussein and his sons are among those still at large. It now looks as if the capture of the entire former Iraqi leadership may take some time yet. The discovery of what appears to be mass graves over the weekend reinforces the brutal nature of a government that murdered and gassed and tortured its opponents, removed entire populations against their will, invaded two of its neighbors, and in the battles against American and British forces, faked surrenders, employed human shields, and mistreated prisoners of war. The necessity for justice is not in dispute, but who should judge guilt and innocence, and where the trial should be held is under debate. Later this hour, a scientist at NOAA's Severe Storm Center will join us to talk about the series of tornadoes that cost so many lives, and we'll also have your letters. But first, the quality and character of post-war justice in Iraq. Who has jurisdiction? Which international laws apply? Are there differences between war crimes and crimes against humanity? Who gets to decide? And how important is it that trials be seen as fair and judges as impartial? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from his home in Berkeley, California, is Eric Stover. He's director of the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley and professor of public health. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Neil.
We're talking, at least in part, about crimes against humanity. Tell us about some of the evidence. What exists right now?
There's overwhelming evidence of the crimes of Saddam Hussein over the last two decades. Just to begin with, keep in mind, in any criminal investigation, whether it's a war crime or it's a local crime in any town in the United States, you're looking for three types of evidence. You're looking for testimonial evidence, which are victims who can come forward and speak about the crimes that have taken place. You're also looking at insiders. I mean, these are people who are close to Saddam or other military leaders who can give evidence. Of that, there is abundance in Iraq. Documentary evidence is your second form of evidence, and this is that sort of proverbial paper trail of detective stories. These are radio broadcasts. They're documents that can be brought out of prisons and so on. Thirdly is physical evidence, and physical evidence are the corpus delicti, the body of the crime, the victims that are going to be found in the mass graves. And of that, there is abundance as well. There is no question that if trials were begun in Iraq today, there would be sufficient evidence to convict many of these alleged war criminals.
Well, sufficient evidence, again, talking about going from, you know, evidence of crimes, certainly, but then evidence that so-and-so committed a specific crime?
Well, no, there's the difference here. When you, just as in the trials in Bosnia, in cases where there are charges of crimes against humanity or genocide, you're not interested necessarily in individuals who may have been killed. You're trying to show widespread and systematic crimes aimed against a specific population or against civilians. So as you go about the country in your investigation, if you can document that there are mass graves in this area and other areas, and that Saddam's forces were responsible for this, and that there were certain military and civilian officials who are responsible, those connections can be made.
Now, is there concern that amidst the looting that some evidence may have been destroyed, or even in terms of forensic evidence, as I understand it, if the relatives of a victim start digging up bodies in mass graves, that spoils their usefulness as evidence?
Well, I think the challenges are, certainly there are some challenges regarding evidence, and that, as you say, is the security of these mass graves. But keep in mind, there are many mass graves, and you don't have to convict someone on simply one site. I mean, there are other sites that can be exhumed. And as I understand, at least around Baghdad, that at least three mass graves have now been secured by American forces and cordoned off. I think the real challenges are not going to be evidentiary. They're going to be the ones that deal with people. Mm-hmm. They're going to be the ones where there's political will, a political will to see that justice is done. And it's something, quite frankly, we haven't seen so far from the Bush administration and from the United Nations. There was no planning to go in and investigate these crimes. The second issue, and this arose both in Bosnia and Kosovo, is that as these investigators go in to collect this evidence, they have to be extremely careful about the way in which they deal with the communities where these graves are. They have to be careful that there's not a backlash, that they take over these sites when the families themselves want to be present and perhaps retrieve the remains from the site. And secondly, they have to be careful not to create great expectations, that once a forensic scientific team moves in, the sense, and this happened in Bosnia and Kosovo, that everyone would be identified usually comes to the fore. And we have to be careful not to broadcast that, to let the communities be part of this process and understand it's going to be a difficult and arduous task, and not everyone's going to be identified.
And a time-consuming process.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, after the first Gulf War, you were involved in, I gather your work was different after the first Gulf War.
Well, after the first Gulf War, I went in with Physicians for Human Rights and Human Rights Watch, two U.S. Human rights organizations. Our forensic team went in essentially to document the mass graves that were left in the wake of the Kurds forcing the Iraqis out of their territory. But even then, we went into a cemetery in Sulaymaniyah in which the grave worker the cemetery worker, he buried bodies with no names and graves, but he methodically he knew some of these people, he kept these records. We understand that this has happened in many other cemeteries around the country, so that's sort of key evidence. We also found in the city of Kirkuk, in a cemetery, the bodies of 11 students who had been executed, all of them bearing blindfolds. And this was fairly consistent evidence that was given by the gravedigger there as well.
And, of course, after the first Gulf War, there were tons of documents seized from former Ba'ath Party headquarters and various places, police stations, that have been collected.
I think it's something like 8 metric tons. It's unbelievable that Human Rights Watch was able to bring out this information, documentary information, and it is now in storage somewhere around Washington, D.C. This can be brought forward for trials as well.
Okay. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Eric Stover is director of the Human Rights Center at the University of California at Berkeley and a professor of public health, and he was with us from his home in Berkeley, California. Evidence is one issue. Prosecuting these crimes, as we suggested, will be another. Where to prosecute them, especially, and who will be the judge? Some say Iraqi citizens should be able to run the trials in their own country. Others say the United Nations should set up tribunals. Some think U.S. judges have lots of involvements in war crimes trials. Joining us now to talk about the range of possibilities are Richard Dicker. He's here in Studio 3A, International Justice Director at Human Rights Watch in New York, and thanks for being with us.
I'm very pleased to be with you.
And also Ruth Wedgwood joins us by phone from Portugal. She's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a John Hopkins Professor of International Law. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Richard, please remind us, which crimes are those against humanity, as we were just talking about with Eric Stover, and how are they different from military crimes?
Well, military crimes traditionally are crimes that are committed in the course of armed conflict, be that armed conflict international in character or internal in character. Those crimes were proscribed in the Geneva Conventions originally and further elaborated on in two additional protocols to the Geneva Conventions.
Mm-hmm.
Crimes against humanity...
Well, first, before you do that, give us a for instance of what might happen.
For instance, execution of unarmed POWs, deliberate intentional execution of unarmed civilians would be classic examples of war crimes prohibited by the Geneva Conventions.
Now, in terms of crimes against humanity, Eric Stover's definition?
Crimes against humanity did not emerge first from that body of international treaty law, has come to be understood as crimes committed in a wide scale or systematic way as part of a plan or policy directed against any civilian population. And there's no nexus or requirement that those crimes against humanity occur in the course of armed conflict. Rape, killings, forced displacement, extermination, enslavement, those acts, so long as they are part of a widespread or systematic plan or policy against a civilian population, would be crimes against humanity.
Ruth Wedgwood, let me bring you in here and ask you specifically about the crimes that would have been committed in the course of the conflict, crimes committed by troops against other troops, also crimes committed by irregular forces, the so-called fedayeen and other kinds of people like that. I gather there is little controversy in international law over who gets to try those people and in what kinds of courts.
Well, those kinds of war crimes where you have abused the norms of battlefield law, including abusing trust relationships, where, for example, the duty of an adversary to take a surrender depends upon the expectation that the surrendering troops are not going to misuse that by having a concealed suicide bomb. Those have traditionally, in fact, been consigned to military tribunals. It's a surprise to some people to hear that, but in Article 84 of the Third Geneva Convention, it sets out that, in fact, to try a prisoner of war, it's preferred that it, in fact, it's demanded that it be in a military court, lest a civilian court not be considered fair. And we've gotten away from that idea in the 90s because of the examples of the Yugoslav and Rwanda tribunals, and, of course, the ICC. But the original Geneva framework, still good law, is that, in fact, a military tribunal is expected to be the most fair forum.
And the ICC, of course, the International Court of Criminal Justice that has just been established. And Richard Dicker, that has been largely ruled out of any role in this for two reasons, if you would explain. One of them, of course, is that neither Iraq nor the United States has ratified that accord.
That's correct. And some of the preconditions of the International Criminal Court taking jurisdiction over a situation and cases arising from a situation such as existed in Iraq is that either the country on whose territories the crimes occurred or the country of nationality of the accused has ratified the treaty. As you said, Neil, in this instance, neither party has. But there's another problem as well, and that is that the ICC's authority only began as of July 1, 2002, which means it can only address crimes that occurred subsequent to that date. The gassing of the Kurds in Halabja that occurred in March of 1988, for example, crimes against humanity against the Shia Arab population in the south, which occurred in 91-92, clearly on a temporal basis far outside the reach of the ICC.
And Ruth Wedgwood, again, the importance of trying these cases which may come up against Iraqi irregular forces or troops who don civilian uniforms and fake surrenders, that sort of thing. Some people have talked about the importance of doing this for its value as a precedent.
Well, I think it's important to maintain the norm that to protect civilians, you have to have clear distinctions between combatants and civilians. If every civilian could be a hidden combatant, then you can be sure that in many wars, civilians will get the worst of it. And to be honest, in some of the later protocols to Geneva, which the U.S. has not ratified, Protocol 1 of 1977, those distinctions began to be erased. There was a sympathy, I think, at that time misplaced for guerrilla movements, which said that to permit guerrillas to operate effectively in so-called wars of national liberation, will forgive their donning of civilian guise so long as they whip out their weapons on the way to the attack. And I think it's important to show that the fundamental norm is that the distinction between civilians and combatants has to be maintained.
When we come back from a break, we'll discuss the more contentious issues over who should be in charge of these trials, where should the jurists be selected from, who should the lawyers be, and where should the trials be held. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about various proposals to prosecute war crimes in Iraq. Our guests are Ruth Wedgwood, an advisor to the Department of Defense on the issue of military tribunals, and Richard Dicker, the International Justice Director at Human Rights Watch, who is with us here in Studio 3A. To join the discussion, give us a phone call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And why don't we go first to Anne, who joins us on the line from Akron, Ohio.
Hi, God bless everyone. An occupying power waging an illegal war has no moral or legal right to judge others. This was the position of Leo Tolstoy, who said that no true follower of Christ could serve on a jury or judge another. And we are ignoring the fact that the bomb-sealed Afghani caves have become mass graves. And we're ignoring the fact that the CIA funded a war by Iraq against Iran. So many of the mass graves are of casualties in that war. And finally, it would be better to have Amnesty International or a true human rights group rather than Human Rights Watch.
Okay. Ruth Wedgwood, there's a lot to chew on there. Who does have the authority?
Well, the one important distinction that's been made in modern law of armed conflict is that the way you fight the war has to be judged independently of what the war is about. So that even if you think the war was illegal, still there's an obligation on both sides to fight the war correctly. And therefore the right to judge deliberate application of those rules still subsists. I think the likeliest, again, forum for crimes against the Iraqi people is in so-called mixed tribunals, which is a combination of Iraqis and some international presence. And for the military crimes against Allied troops, in a mixed military commission of the Allied troops, mm-hmm. which could include Muslim judges.
There are also proposals to get the United Nations more directly involved. Richard Dicker?
Well, I think it's worth stepping back for just one second, which is to look at the point that in this transition that Iraq is going through right now, that it's essential that those who have responsibility for the horrific crimes that have occurred in Iraq over the last three decades, and I mean genocide against the Kurds, crimes against humanity against the Marsh Arabs, war crimes against the Kuwaitis in that invasion, those most responsible must be held to account under the rule of law in order to build respect for law and human rights in a post-Saddam Hussein Iraq. That's the issue here, really. And from that perspective, any court trying those individuals must be independent of political influence, must be impartial in applying the law, and must provide those accused, however horrific the crimes of which they're accused, with a fair trial. Those three basic principles must be embodied in a mechanism for justice if justice is to be done and seen as being done.
Mm-hmm. An email question that we got from Joseph Corcoran. Who is the convening authority for these trials, Ruth Wedgwood?
Well, in the case of a commission that was hearing crimes on the battlefield, the convening authority would usually be the commander of the particular military force. So in this case, it would be, in some sense, President Bush, or President Bush together with his allied leaders. It's a military authority. In the case of mixed tribunals to try such things as Richard is talking of the genocide in the north and the south, there it may be more complicated. You could do this through an agreement between the Iraqi interim authority or a newly elected Iraqi government and the allies. It could be blessed and have holy water sprinkled upon it by Kofi Annan and be signed and sealed and delivered in the 38th floor of Turtle Bay, or it could just be done in Baghdad itself.
Mm-hmm. Who can file a complaint? Another question from Joseph Corcoran.
Well, typically, you'll want some kind of filtering device because you have to figure out who you're going to try and for what in a efficient way. One of the problems of the Yugoslav and the Rwanda tribunals has been, frankly, that they haven't been able to make the best use often of their trial time. So you'd have a prosecutor who would take complaints from individuals coming forward and then figure out how to triage the possible universe of defendants. I think one of the hard lessons of realpolitik here is that we're going to get the cooperation of some of these people to decipher Iraq's connection to weapons of mass destruction and to terrorist groups. So at times we may need to gain some cooperation from some very bad guys, as in Germany after World War II, and therefore sometimes I think there'll be determinate prison sentences instead of the sentences we might like.
A plea bargaining, essentially.
Essentially.
Okay. Joining us now by phone from Los Angeles is Sermet Al-Saraf. He's an attorney of Iraqi descent who lived in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. He's also a member of the Iraqi Jurist Association, the largest group of lawyers, judges, and law professors outside of Iraq, and he's on the phone with us from Los Angeles. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
How would you like to see the war crimes prosecuted in Iraq?
Well, I think it's more important to ask how would the Iraqi people like to see the prosecutions occur in Iraq. And I think it's clear that the Iraqi people themselves were the biggest population of victims of Saddam Hussein. And as a result, we would like to see a domestic court of Iraqi jurists with international support. And the reason for that, there are many different reasons. Primarily, Iraq has a juristic or legal tradition that predates Saddam Hussein. This is not a country like Rwanda or Afghanistan where it's been difficult to reassemble a judicial operation or function within the country. As such, and many people in the West may not understand or may not appreciate the fact that there are jurists both inside and outside Iraq who are more than capable of handling these prosecutions.
But wouldn't most of those, if not all of those, who had been in Iraq these last 25 years or so have been tainted by their association with the government?
Well, no, not at all. There are a series of jurists inside the country who, as an example, those who were forcibly retired because they refused to go along with the Ba'ath party line. Those who were exiled, also many of whom fled the country because they refused to accept it. And then we also have to understand that the Ba'ath party co-opted and coerced individuals to join the party. So being a member of the Ba'ath party, by itself, I don't think is a reason for prosecution or to assume that they are loyal supporters of Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to those who think that if there were courts erected under an American-sponsored government in Iraq, even though it was run by Iraqis, would represent kangaroo courts?
Well, I disagree with that, and I also challenge the international community, most of whom sat on the sidelines. And, it's been 15 years since the chemical bombing of Halabja, which happened in front of the international community. The international community failed to even acknowledge or take any steps to redress the crimes committed against the Iraqi people. So I think it's highly hypocritical at this point to insist on an international tribunal when, in fact, the international community has had plenty of time to assemble a commission of experts or a tribunal. I think what's more important is that the international community acknowledge the fact that there are, credible and qualified jurists inside the country who are more than capable of establishing a judicial system and reestablishing rule of law. And that's what's important. The importance is that we establish a rule of law environment. And the minute you take these prosecutions away from the Iraqi people, you're by definition saying that the Iraqi people are incapable of establishing rule of law.
Mm-hmm. Are you and members of your group, the Iraqi Jurist Association, are you hoping to go back to help out?
Yes, in fact, one of our members is on his way there as we speak, and we've published a 700-page, the Iraqi Jurist Association, in conjunction with the Working Group on Transitional Justice, which was a project of the Future of Iraq project at the State Department, published a 700-page report that details specific recommendations on how to reestablish rule of law, and one of those aspects involves the prosecutions of potential war criminals.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Sermet Al-Saraf is an attorney of Iraqi descent who lived in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. He's a member of the Iraqi Jurist Association, and he was with us on the phone from Los Angeles. We're talking with Ruth Wedgwood, a senior fellow of the Council on Foreign Relations, and also Johns Hopkins International Law Professor, and with Richard Dicker, an International Justice Director, or the International Justice Director at Human Rights Watch, about the prospect of war crimes trials following the war in Iraq. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our Our email address is totn@npr.org. And an email question from Peter Roosmanier, and I hope I'm not mispronouncing that too badly. What rights would a tribunal have to force discovery of evidence in the possession of Western powers, including the United States? Richard?
Well, I think that's a very important question, and really gets back to what the actual issue is that we're confronting here. Unfortunately, the Department of Defense and Department of State 3 weeks ago announced their proposal for how these trials should be handled. They suggested an Iraqi-led, U.S.-supported effort. Human Rights Watch and others have profound concerns about the impartiality, fairness, and independence of such an Iraqi-led, U.S. government-supported tribunal. And there's a link between the ability of such tribunal to seek evidence that might be implicating U.S. authorities or others in some of the crimes that occurred. But the issue here is that over 30 years of Ba'ath Party rule, the independent judiciary in Iraq was devastated. Political interference was the norm, and independent lawyers and judges were either killed, exiled, or silenced. You cannot create, by wave of a magic wand, an independent court system that has the capacity to try the most complicated, highly charged legal trials imaginable, that would be war crimes, genocide, etc., against former Iraqi leaders. That's why we believe the State Department, Defense Department approach is ill-conceived, and rather than project justice, will project victor's justice, which we think will be an impediment to reestablishing the rule of law environment our Iraqi colleague was speaking about. We think there are two possible ways to go. Either you create an international tribunal through the UN Security Council, or, as Professor Wedge was referring to a moment ago, you create a mixed tribunal, but that would be a mixed tribunal that includes a preponderance of international jurists, indeed many from the Arab world, to help see that the proceedings are fair, independent, and impartial, and have the capacity to seek evidence from the U.S. government or other Western governments that might shed light on guilt or innocence of those accused before.
Ruth Wedgwood, I wanted to get your response to that.
Well, I think the notion that only by removing justice from the scene of the crimes can you have a fair proceeding is, it would be a very sad comment on what you could hope for from Iraqi democracy. I mean, one of the continuing criticisms of both the Rwanda tribunal and the Yugoslav tribunal, which are in the Arusha, Tanzania, and the Hague, Netherlands, good work, though, they've done, for sure, is that they removed the process of coming to accounts from the scene of the political reconstruction, and that they were enterprises of people from all over the world, everybody but the local people. I think a healthy mixture of international personnel and local personnel is greatly preferable. There's a huge Iraqi exile population that can come back to help. And I think the example that your last caller gave of people who may have been forcibly retired, who have visibly and bravely shown their dissent from the regime, shows that there'll be Iraqi lawyers to draw upon. And as well, you can involve Iraqi people as lay assessors of fact. They don't have to be LLMs from Harvard Law School to be able to take part in a trial, just as we have jurors who take part not knowing the law directly. But I do think, for the sense of vindication of the Iraqi people, that they can sit in judgment on their own dictator who abused them so badly over the years and not see themselves as a creature of multilateral colonialism is a very important step. On information the U.S. may have, I mean, this is always delicate in the sense that sources and methods are necessary to protect in order to have ongoing access to the same kind of intelligence that you need. People can make the claim, and it's a fair one, I suppose, that we were too tolerant of Saddam in the late 80s, that we should have said more about the Halabja gas campaign. We had a resolution of condemnation in the UN, but not with any sufficient vigor. But that said, I think in our own minds what we were doing was supporting, or at least tolerating, Saddam against the greater evil of the Iran of Khomeini. But I think in retrospect we might well have done things differently.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's go to Yolanda, who joins us on the line from Van Nuys in California.
Yes, I am trying to just propose the idea that someone consider the process that was used in South Africa called Truth and Reconciliation. I don't hear any discussion about that. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful process, but it does require a lot of forgiveness.
Richard Dicker, first tell us a little bit about what that is and then what you think of it.
I
was posing that question to one of our guests, Yolanda. Hold on one second.
Yeah.
What our caller was referring to was the process initiated in South Africa after the end of apartheid there, whereby individuals step forward and before a Truth and Reconciliation Commission confessed the crimes, the murders, the torturing, etc., that they were responsible for under the apartheid regime, and in response were given an amnesty from criminal prosecution for those crimes.
And it seemed to work very well in South Africa.
In South Africa, the process has indeed worked well. I think there are important distinctions between South Africa's process and what we're looking at in Iraq. First and foremost, from a human rights perspective, there can be no amnesty under international law for the crimes of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Mm. That's our belief in terms of what international law requires. So there is room, Yolanda, for a Truth and Reconciliation or Truth Commission in Iraq to handle those individuals who might confess crimes of lesser magnitude. We started our discussion with the need for a court to try the most senior leaders. I think it's possible to have this court located in Iraq, taking on board Professor Wedgwood's concern. We can locate this court in Iraq, but let me highlight one real problem for an Iraqi tribunal only. Witnesses may want to come forward to speak on behalf of accused. Mm-hmm. Who will provide real safety and security for witnesses who want to speak in very unpopular ways on behalf of accused Iraqi leaders? And that's why we think some form of international tribunal will be much fairer. That can be located in Iraq.
Okay. Neil, could I just respond to that?
And we just have about a minute left, Ruth, so you get the last word here.
Real quick, which is that's a problem that's common to the international tribunals, too. One of the real problems in The Hague has been that Bosnians coming forward have virtually no protection when they come home. So between national courts and international courts, so that issue of witness protection is a wash. I do think that the lesson most people take away from the 90s is that, yes, you do have to use lesser processes of reconciliation, even for genocide, because often genocides involve a great many people. You can try a few people, as we have in The Hague, but you can't try the whole population.
Ruth Wedgwood, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ruth Wedgwood on the phone with us from Portugal. She's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Richard Dicker was with us here in Studio 3A. We appreciate your joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Richard Dicker is the International Justice Director at Human Rights Watch. When we come back from a break, we'll turn to the tornadoes in the Midwest. Dozens spawned by severe weather yesterday. Dozens of people left dead in their wake. And we'll also learn how kids can learn ham radio, your letters. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.